I'd like to call the meeting of the Higher Education Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 29th. Representative Isaacson, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Thoroughly vetted and very excited to move the minutes. Thank you.
Thank you for moving the minutes for March 23rd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Okay. Representative Dean. Representative Dean will present his bill, and I'll move House File 3130 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for moving House File 3130 and bringing the bill before the committee. I appreciate the committee's time. I know how busy you are right now with the session, so I appreciate the time to do that. I will be as brief as possible. This bill deals with the University of Minnesota, and to all of the people who are here from the University of Minnesota, go Gophers. Appreciate all of the students who came today to advocate for the U, including my daughter, who I just saw up in my committee. So I appreciate the folks who are here. We are looking at fetal tissue research at the University of Minnesota, and this goes to some of the reporting and some of the issues that we have dealt with already this year within the legislature. And the research dealing with the procurement, the research and the disposition of fetal remains at the university has been controversial, and we've gotten some different messages from the U that we're trying to work through. And what I thought would be kind of incumbent upon us as a legislature is to say, what are the rules that currently apply to the university? What are the laws? What are the federal laws that apply to the University of Minnesota? What are the state laws that apply to the University of Minnesota? What are the internal protocols and rules and guidelines that the university has that on their code of ethics and their policies and procedures for handling this? Are we following them? Did we follow them? What happened? And how do we move forward? So I thought that it would make sense to do that. In my earliest discussions with the university after reaching out, these were the discussions that I had. I thought it would make sense to work within the Office of the Legislative Auditor to do that. They are uniquely positioned to do that with us, and they have the experience and the manpower to do that, to work with the University of Minnesota. I also talked to Auditor Nobles about that briefly earlier this year, and we have put together a bill that basically asks the university, or excuse me, asks the legislative auditor either directly or through a contract to answer those first three questions that I laid out of the state law, federal law, and internal university policies, guidelines for ethical research. Are we following them? Are we not following them? And what needs to be done? My office was contacted by Jim Nobles earlier and said that the OLA is planning on moving forward with that. The OLA, in even better news, has said that he will be requiring no additional money to do that. We always appreciate that. And they will start in a few weeks. And Mr. Nobles is here and can also answer any questions about that. I wanted to make sure that we kept the bill before us because I think it is important to understand that the legislature is interested in specific things that we want to come out of this report. And I certainly want to work together with the auditor's office as well as the university to make sure that these and other important questions are answered. So with that, Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Or also, I understand that Mr. Nobles and also Dr. Herman is here from the University of Minnesota, as well as I see some government relations staff from the university as well to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Veen. I just have one quick question, and then we'll go to the rest of the questions from the members. You had said that, put it in a current context as far as are we currently following, will there be a retrospective look at it to see if there was that was being followed in the past?
Yes, and I think that that's really the extent to which we can do that, and I'm looking for a date within the legislation, a look-back period, and I'm not seeing it. Has been previously used in 1.12, and I think it looks it is retrospective without a specific date, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, questions for Representative Dean before we move on? Representative Joaquin.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Sorry, thank you, Chair. Just a real quick question, Representative Dean, and maybe for the OLA, I'm not sure which. What is this? What does the OLA hope to ascertain that the Huron report that we just got on March 16th of this year, or 17th of this year, didn't already tell us? It looks like a lot of the findings that you're looking for, according to the report. Sorry, I meant to print it out, but I didn't get a chance to. We already got answers to. So I'm just wondering, what more were you hoping to learn,
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Joaquin, thank you for pointing out that this is the University of Minnesota study that was completed by the Huron Consulting Group, and that does go into several of the pieces of information that we are looking at. It does not actually look at federal or state law compliance, so that is one area where it doesn't quite overlap, and it may very well be, and I'd ask the auditor to respond to this for himself, but it may very well be that he can use pieces of this for his own analysis to build on, so that the work that the university has done for fetal tissue research assessment in their final report on March 17th does not have to be replicated, but certainly don't want to limit the work of the auditor to that. And it is, I guess I would ask Mr. Nobles how the auditor's office does that and what he might do. But he could probably, much better than I, walk through what his next steps might be and how he might use that for himself.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And I guess I would answer your question by referencing what we're doing right now at the university, and that is we are doing a follow-up review of psychiatric research. We've issued two reports in that area last year. We're doing a follow-up review, and we're always building on other reports that have already been done. For example, with psychiatric research studies, drug studies, we built upon an outside expert panel that the university brought in to look at the Department of Psychiatry. We met with the people who did that work. We examined their work papers, their report. And there are also other reports that are similar that the university has commissioned from an outside source. You may be aware that there were some controversies about the athletic department. The university brought in an outside investigator to examine the events that occurred. We met with that investigator. We read the report. We examined work papers. So we'll do the same with this. We'll build on what's already been done. But where we see a need to do additional work, we will do that.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Any other questions? Your fellow representative Joaquin?
Thank you, Chair. I do actually, maybe just to understand a little bit more what resources that you'll go to if it's outside of maybe your area of expertise. Like on the bill on line 1.23, it says only when necessary to see if the policies include provisions to ensure fetal tissue is used in research only when necessary. Do you have medical doctors in the OLA that'll help decide that, or would you reach out to outside resources?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as with other evaluations, and specifically I'd refer back to the work we did and are currently doing in the Department of Psychiatry, yes, we consulted with a group of experts, psychiatrists. We also read a great deal of literature, but we reach out to people who are experts in the field, both ones that are made available to us by the university, but ones we seek out and communicate with as well.
Cindy Joachim, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair. No, thank you. That helps clear up a little bit for me. I'm a little worried about using, and I know, thank you for taking away the appropriation. That was a little concerning, but I know it is also still state money that runs your office, so I worry about replicating work that's already been done with taxpayer money. So, thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
So, Nobles, how familiar are you with the previous audit done on the fetal tissue research?
Madam Chair, we've reviewed it. We've reviewed a number of documents already. You might remember that this topic was on our list as a potential evaluation topic. So we were developing background material on this previous to my agreement last week to go ahead and do this as a special review.
Mm-hmm. Representative Weiss.
And so I had to step out just for a second, so if I missed it, I apologize for repeating ourselves, but substantially what we're talking about being different from the first audit we talked about was just the review of how we complied with state and federal laws prior to 2010, is that correct? Or is there more to it that you'd be doing beyond what the Huron study did?
Mr. Nobles.
Well, I mean, we will get into the evaluation and examine that and make that judgment you know, as we learn more about what is going on at the university. I mean, we will use a variety of sources, not just that report, but others as well. We'll certainly be interviewing people at the university. We're currently, as I said, dealing with many of the same people. Dr. Herman, the Vice President for Research, we're dealing with a good deal on the psychiatric issues. So we'll use our normal methodologies of looking at a wide range of documents, interviewing a wide range of people.
And then, Representative Dean, would you say that you were not satisfied with the Huron study and that's why you want to do this, or just trying to understand what more needs to be discovered that I might have missed and just trying to get understand where this is coming from, I guess, a little bit more? That'd be great.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair and Representative Isaacson, actually, I mean, I started working on this before that I knew that there was a report coming out. But I think as legislators and all of us want to make sure that we feel comfortable that the issue is being taken care of, I would applaud the U for beginning its own internal investigation, you know, without us having to ask for that. So I would commend them for doing that. But I also think that the Legislative Auditor's Office will give comfort to Minnesotans who might want to have assurance that this is an independent view of the program to make sure that when we are completed and moving forward, that we are complying with state and federal laws and that we are adhering to the ethical standards of the university. That's something that we can be proud of from the outside looking in. And so that for that reason, I wanted to make sure that we move forward with legislation to do that.
Representative Isaac, can you have a follow-up?
Yes, Madam Chair. So, and maybe there's a mechanism here I'm not familiar with. So you, Mr. Nobles, have already under special authority are doing an audit. And then simultaneously, parallel, you're writing a bill to ensure that we do an audit?
Representative
Dean? Those two, did I miss something there? Do you need one to do the other or not?
Madam Chair and Representative Isaacson, the legislative auditor has complete authority to investigate and do what they need to do independently. Occasionally, the legislature will ask the legislative auditor to do a specific audit, which his office will do. And we will also provide additional funds necessary. Sometimes the legislative auditor does that internally. Sometimes they will hire it out for a specialty purpose. Or in the case of last year, I think we provided some resources to the legislative auditor, and they returned those dollars to us when the audit was unnecessary or substantially complete. So sometimes we do it. We ask the legislative auditor to do stuff. Sometimes he does it independently with consultation with the legislature, looking for ideas and what we need.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nobles, do you need this legislation to do your audit?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson and members of the committee, I do not, but I don't oppose it in any way. I mean, I think it shows the level of interest that the legislature has. Frankly, we already knew that it had a high level of interest among legislators from the results of your voting on topics. So, again, last week when all of the various topics that we were considering for evaluations were before the Legislative Audit Commission, the members of the Legislative Audit Commission and I had a conversation about this particular topic, particularly because we are, as I've said before, already at the university doing research in a similar area, and that is clinical research, in this case involving live human beings, and the case with fetal tissue involving fetal tissue.
Madam Chair.
Thank
you. Well, first of all, I'm very happy you're doing the audit on the psychiatric side of that. I think that's very good. But my understanding is that if this bill weren't to pass, that in no way affects whether you're going to get your audit done. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I've made a commitment to do this.
Right.
Made that commitment last week before the Legislative Audit Commission. They concurred that it's something that we should do and
right.
that we will use our existing resources. I personally will be involved in the research with my legal counsel and anyone else that we need to be involved.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing the bill forward. And Auditor Nobles, I just had a quick question. You just mentioned legal counsel, and I'm not very familiar with how the legislative auditor goes about investigating compliance to state and federal laws. And so I'm aware that there is some disagreement right now within the legal community about some of the University of Minnesota's compliance to these laws. So how will the office address that? Will you just report kind of both sides, or how does that work?
Mr. Noble.
Chair, members of the committee, we are almost, well, I would say literally daily, involved in many legal issues. We do a great deal of compliance work. It's what we do. And so we are constantly having to review statutes, review case law, federal law. We are the auditor of the state's compliance with federal law as well. So we do have in-house legal counsel. We also often seek legal counsel from House legal counsel, Senate legal counsel. We also have the authority to look at the legal opinions that the university has obtained on this issue. We, in fact, already have those and have reviewed them. It's my understanding that university has put those under attorney-client privilege, but they are available to us, and we've reviewed them. So we will indeed review all the various legal arguments related to this, and to the degree we feel comfortable, we'll come to our own opinion. If we believe there's ambiguity in the law, that's what we'll say.
No, thank you, and thank you, Chair Nobles, or Auditor Nobles.
Any other member questions? Representative Dean, did you want to have another testifier, or?
No, I just want to thank the auditor for his time and work in advance of this. And just, you know, very briefly, a few years ago, we at the legislature were grappling with the University of Minnesota stem cell research and how that was going to play out and where we were going to go. And then with the sudden advancements in stem cell research for non-embryonic pluripotent stem cells, everybody just kind of breathed a sigh of relief that technology had hurdled the ethical problem that we had. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of people, it took their eye off the ball for the ethics issues within that. And now we're kind of, this year, kind of got a queasy feeling in her stomach like, oh, it's back, or we missed the ball on this. So I'm very happy that the auditor and the university are very focused on this, as well as many legislators on both sides of the aisle who are very interested in making sure that we're following the highest ethical standards as well as state and federal law on this. So I appreciate the committee's time and would appreciate your support going forward for the audit as well as for other legislation for oversight, which is our job. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Dean. So this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify for or have voice concerns with the bill? Okay, seeing none, then we are laying this over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, staff, and members.
Representative McDonald, your bill is up.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3083.
Representative McDonald, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 3083.
Okay, and that will be laid over. And just a reminder, so those that are testifying today, we have a 1 to 2 minute limit because we have a long list of testifiers. And Representative McDonald, to your bill.
Madam Chair, I also have an amendment, the A-16 amendment. I'd like to move that.
Okay, you'd like to move your amendment, the A-16?
A-16.
Okay, so we move the A-16. Do you want to speak to the amendment, or do you want us to put it in the shape that you would like?
I'd rather get the bill in the shape I would like.
Okay. Representative McDonald moves the A-16 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay.
Board members, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just briefly, let me tell, just share with you the problem, and then we'll share with you some solutions, then I'll let my testifiers go. We fully recognize we got less than 10 minutes to get the job accomplished. So this is nothing new to you members. We have a problem in our state with remedial courses with students. So the problem is that 1 in 4 Minnesota students, high school graduates, have to take remedial courses when they get to college. That's the problem. Students don't earn a credit for the classes, but they have to pay full prices. That's a problem, especially in our student debt. As you know, it is severe. Students across Minnesota are affected in suburb, city, and greater Minnesota. That's a problem. Students of color and low-income students are affected at higher rates. That's a problem. Black and low-income students are nearly twice as likely as their peers to require remediation. More than half of all black high school students in Minnesota require remedial courses in their first 2 years of college. That's a problem. All of these students met the requirements for a diploma. All of these students met the requirements for the diploma in high school in the state of Minnesota. All of them. Yet, they were not college ready. That's a problem. Remedial classes and time and cost that the students deter them from getting the degrees. I see that's a problem. Most students enrolled in remedial classes don't finish college. That's a problem. So my solution, our solution, is proposing a comprehensive approach that will increase college readiness within school. That's a good thing. It'll increase student retention and enrollment in higher level courses. That's a good thing. And it'll increase college completion rates. That's a great thing. And it'll reduce the debt of the students as they graduate from school and have them ready to get in to get a degree and to be productive in our state. That's a great thing. So with that, I will turn my, I'll open it to questions if you want. Otherwise, I'm done with my opening, and I'll turn it over to my testifier, and she will go through some details and just further educate you on the issue.
Okay, I believe we have a member question already, Representative.
Madam Chair, I would like to know your preference. Would you like me to wait until all the testifiers go and then we can have the discussion? Would that be easier?
Let's hear that, Representative Isaac.
Sounds great.
We have quite a few testifiers and they might answer your question.
Happy to be a team player.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Ms. Candy here as one of my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue your testimony.
Hello, Chair O'Neill and committee members. My name is Latasha Gandy, and I am the Minnesota Executive Director for Students for Education Reform. Students for Education Reform is a nonprofit organization that organizes community members and college students to be educational fighters in their local community. This year, ESFR launched a Demand More campaign to address the inequities within our current education system. In particular, to House File 3083, we are demanding more differentiated support for our higher education institutions. We agree there is no one-size-fit model for all students, and we know the professors are doing the best they can. They're going above and beyond. However, the system is broken, and our kids are paying the price, while also widening the achievement gap that persists through K-12 and into higher education. This issue is important to me personally because I too falsely was prepared to go to college. And while I needed developmental courses in writing, I don't necessarily feel I needed a full developmental course in math. I spent money and time that I didn't have that I could have been used in other meaningful ways in my education. This experience is just not mine. It's the same experience that many students and community members have felt within our organization. And this is why it's become an issue our students demand we tackle. We would like to see free developmental courses to students graduated from high school within the last 5 years. And we would like to see accelerated pathways across MinSCU that are credit-bearing to support students who could be successful without taking a straight remedial course. This would include co-requisite courses, supplemental instruction, or contextualized learning courses. Lastly, we want to see concurrent enrollment expanded to allow students to receive remediation while still in high school to ensure they are prepared to enter college ready to take a college course. Last year, we were really proud when we saw the legislator create the post-secondary attainment goal, and we truly believe this is a strategy to get you there. Lastly, last year, you told MNSCU to create a remedial plan, and they came back with a one bullet point mention on how to address remediation. That's not enough, and this issue needs to be taken more seriously. And by passing House File 3083, you are doing so.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's move on to the next testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Kevin Parker, and I am the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. We represent 150,000 of our public, community, and technical college students. We want to thank Representative McDonald for bringing forth this bill. House File 3083 is another example of legislation aimed at keeping this important discussion around developmental education going in a positive direction. As a statewide association representing the vast majority of students who take developmental education, we hear every day about the challenges that students face, both in the time delay and the extra costs associated with traditional developmental education courses. As we've said to this committee in the past, our students pay the third highest tuition and fees in the nation, and extra costs, which lead to no college credit, can be the difference for some between finishing a degree and dropping out. As a state, we cannot afford to place additional roadblocks before populations of students who already face so many. Particularly as open enrollment institutions, we see students of color, first-generation students, veterans, non-traditional students, students from every vulnerable category who this is a particularly strong roadblock for. And at its core, this is a teaching and learning issue. We want our students to have the best chance to succeed in college, and for some, traditional developmental classes are the right path. However, as our state's needs for a well-trained workforce grows and our economy changes, the need for more Minnesotans to obtain an associate's degree makes this an issue of serving students and our state. It demands a system that meets students where they are, not necessarily one that forces students to meet our colleges where they want them to be. We know that many of our MNSCU campuses are doing innovative work on the developmental education front. And for that, we are grateful. We know there are hardworking faculty, staff, and administrators who are doing their best for students. We want to be sure that the best ideas are shared and that all students have the chance to receive the assistance they need to be successful in college. House File 3083 offers a number of important ideas for doing exactly that. The legislation pushes for a new approach, one that could make college a reality for some who right now are not making it past that developmental education portion. It calls for implementation of new approaches that will likely be of great benefit to students. And it places a high priority on the importance of quality academic advising for those students who need it most. This is an issue that's been of high priority for our students this year and will likely continue to be into the future. Madam Chair, members, thank you again for this chance to address you today. And thank you for taking on this issue. We know that positive changes to our higher education system, specifically in our developmental education field, can have a real impact on our students and our state. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Just want to remind testifiers, when you come up, if you could limit your comments to 1 to 2 minutes, that would really help us move along. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue your testimony.
My name is John Squires, and I'm with the Southern Regional Education Board. And I'm here to testify regarding what other states are doing. I started a similar project in Tennessee. There are similar efforts in other states such as Kentucky, Washington, Indiana, South Carolina, New York, Alabama. This concept of opening up the doors to students who need developmental studies and putting that in the high schools where it belongs is truly a game changer. In Kentucky, in 5 years, they have seen their remediation rates cut in half by doing this. It literally cost the state nothing to do it, and yet they have expanded these opportunities to get a head start on college to all students. In Tennessee, in 3 years, we will have literally cut the remediation rate by about 75%, and have saved the state about $10 to $12 million a year in tuition and fees for students. The fact is, national studies show time and again that students getting a head start on college has a tremendous impact on both college enrollment and college success. But the other fact is, most of these opportunities are limited to good students at good schools. if you open up the opportunity to get a head start on the college career, even if that is developmental studies, you can have a tremendous impact on these students who are disproportionately affected by this hurdle. In Tennessee, Harvard University is now doing a study on the program in Tennessee, and they're going to find that it has had both a significant impact on high school graduation rates and college enrollment rates. The underprepared students in Tennessee in this program are now enrolling in college at a rate of 60%. That rate used to be in the 40s. That is a game changer in terms of meeting your educational and workforce training needs for your state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, the next testifier. State your name for the record and continue the testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 3083. We believe this is an excellent next step in your efforts to increase post-secondary completion rates, as well as recognition of the work already being done by some of our post-secondary institutions. What's most important is this bill continues the shift to focusing on individual student needs and then customizing instruction. As the handout from the Complete College America report shows, and it's the blue one, our traditional approach to post-secondary remediation is not meeting the needs of most students. However, by shifting to a co-requisite approach to helping students catch up on needed skills, while simultaneously being enrolled in credit-bearing courses, we can significantly improve student success. Co-requisite courses are one option, and House File 3083 identifies others, so we shouldn't limit ourselves to just these options, which is why the language in Subdivision 3 is so helpful. There are successful strategies being developed or used at some Minsky institutions, some of which were identified in Minsky's college completion report. That said, the language in Subdivision 3 provides legislative support for ongoing, system-wide efforts to evaluate program effectiveness with the goal of replicating successful strategies. Finally, the information provided by the report in Subdivision 6 will help you and others identify effective practices and track our ability to better serve students. Thank you, and we'd ask that you support House File 3083.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the committee, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. My name is Paku Yang, and I am System Director of P20 and College Readiness at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I appreciate this opportunity to share some feedback about House File 3083. There are a couple of important factors to consider when it comes to understanding developmental education. Many of the earlier testifiers have already stated this, but it is important to note that Minsky serves a diverse student population. For example, across Minsky as a whole, 54% of our students are first generation, 36% of PAL eligible, the average age is 26, and 24% of our students are students of color or American Indian. As the open access public higher education system in the state of Minnesota, we recognize that many of our students arrive at college with academic gaps that needs to be addressed to ensure success with college-level coursework. Understanding that each of our institutions serves their local community based on that community's unique needs, we feel that it is important that each Minsky institution has the ability to create localized and specialized programs that best meet the needs of their students and their communities. A one-size-fits-all model will not allow us to equitably serve these diverse student populations across the state. Our colleges and universities already employ a range of evidence-based practices to support students in developmental education. For example, our colleges and universities offer options including multiple math pathways, accelerated learning programs, learning communities, integrated reading and writing curriculum, StatWay or QuantWay programs in math, and the usage of computer-based programming such as ALEKS. some of our campuses also have supplemental instruction programs in place. System-wide, we also have efforts to better streamline and support developmental education. Through our system-wide assessment for course placement committee, we are looking into multiple measures for course placement. In addition, we have system-wide faculty groups meeting to look at developmental education practices across our campuses. Through these intentional efforts and other initiatives, the enrollment of students in developmental education has decreased from 29% to 27% across the state of Minnesota. Within MinSCU, we have had a 17% decrease in student headcount in developmental education from 2011 to 2014. As our K-12 partners increase the number of students that meet career and college readiness benchmarks by the time that they graduate, we should also see reduced numbers of students needing developmental education. We do have some specific feedback regarding the current bill. For example, the term supplemental instruction denotes a specific program in higher education. The definition provided in this bill uses a different definition, and more clarification is needed. Many of our campuses do not have the infrastructure to provide one-on-one advising at the scale that would be needed to meet the expectations of this bill. There are also fiscal implications for increasing advising, usage of multiple measures in the course placement process, and usage of diagnostics to help students identify academic strengths and weaknesses. Last of all, we caution against the inclusion of prescriptive support strategies in the bill. Although our campuses employ many of these support strategies, we want to ensure the flexibility that allows campuses to use new evidence-based innovations as the research and developmental education grows in the coming years. In summary, MinSCU believes that developmental education innovations to increase student outcomes are necessary, but these innovations need to be guided by accurate data, sound research, and adequate funding and resources. We all know that there is no silver bullet in meeting the needs of diverse students. MinSCU is committed to serving every student that walks through our doors, meeting them where they're at, as Kevin Parker stated earlier, and doing everything that we can to ensure that they are successful, especially those in need of additional academic support to achieve their post-secondary educational goals. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
I'm Ben Kiley, English faculty member. I'm representing the MSCF faculty, two-year college faculty. Madam Chair, committee members, I'm also going to provide a bit of feedback from a faculty perspective on some of the language and some of the ideas presented in the bill. I want to begin. I think that the bill, as written, illustrates a rather incomplete understanding of the two-year college system. Some of the recommendations in the bill would work great at a four-year campus where the student population is different, the infrastructure is different. At a two-year campus, we have a more dynamic student population, the one that Paku just described. I'm most focused as a faculty member on subdivision 3 and this concept of prescribing implementation. So the board is able to prescribe implement any successful strategy or programming solution, you name it, where they see fit. And this works against the message of autonomous innovation that is also built into the bill. I want to state that forcing such programming on campuses system-wide overlooks how distinct and unique each of our campuses truly are. Student population, facilities, programs, infrastructure, faculty expertise, you name it. It's a really dynamic system. We're not robotic. So forcing any kind of implementation system-wide would cause some serious problems. But should the board require implementation, who is responsible for faculty and staff development and training around these redesigns? And this is an important question because these innovations have to be scaled carefully. They have to be scaled methodically. They can't be done overnight. And they're going to require significant investment. And this is really the important point, right? And it's sort of an engineering 101, right? You're developing a product. You can get it good. You can get it fast. You can get it cheap. You get two of three of those. You don't get all three. Without adequate funding, we're going to sacrifice the efficacy of any beneficial programming we put forward. Additionally, reading faculty are particularly concerned about the language in this bill. How does reading and study skills as its own distinct credential field fit into this bill? Are they locked into doing supplemental instruction? Are they locked into co-requisite programming at all turns? Is this about reducing cost, or is this about reducing instruction? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's move to member questions, and we're going to start with Representative Isaacson. I think you had the first one. Okay, and then we'll have Representative Norton. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Representative McDonald, at the very beginning, you had stated kind of a demonstration of a problem and explain what it was. Can you walk me through those first three again that you had mentioned, or is that off the top of your head and you don't quite have them?
Madam Chair?
Oh, sorry, Representative.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I certainly can if we have time. We have the time for me to go through the first three steps.
You had named problem, then that's a problem, and then that's a problem, and that's a problem, and there was something about that I wanted to catch and understand better.
Sure.
Yes, Representative McDonald, to his point.
Well, I'll go from the top of my head, but I have the sheet in front of me. So the statistics that I have is 1 in 4 high school graduates have to take remedial courses.
Right. And that is a problem.
Would you agree?
Students that students don't earn the credit for that class, but they have to pay the full cost of the tuition.
Right.
That's a problem. And then my third one out of six, actually, students across Minnesota, suburbs, greater Minnesota, and the cities are all affected. And those were my three top bullet points.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure I had that correct before I said anything. I think that... I've worked with you before, and I've actually enjoyed our interactions and talking about these bills, and I suspect that I'm assuming that this really does come from a place that I think is really good in problem-solving and trying to find some solutions for students. I think that there's two real fundamental assumption errors that are going on here, one at like a macro level and one at a micro level. The macro level fundamental assumption error, and based on some of the testimony I heard and what I've heard from you and in the bill, is that somehow Minsky having standards that accept students at a certain rate is a problem, right? And that's fundamentally where we have one error here. To assume that just because the K-12 system doesn't educate to the level that our college is required to be at doesn't mean that Minsky is doing something wrong. And I think that's a problem we have in this situation in how I'm reading and the testimony I've heard. And with that fundamental assumption, then we begin to go down all kinds of avenues of discussion related to where fault lies and how are we going to solve it. Right? Because this discussion belongs squarely in K-12, where this problem needs to be fixed, period, in my mind. But we've already kind of went past that, but I struggle with that first concept as an overall assumption on this, that we're asking the Minsky schools to engage in something that they're inheriting that wasn't of their doing, right? And we still want them to stay at a high level academically so they have a good standard. Yet we're not happy when our high school kids are going there and they don't naturally meet that standard despite having a diploma from a Minnesota high school. So fundamentally, I think we've got a disconnect there, because the problem then should be we need to take a look at K-12 and ask, why are our students not getting there? Now, the second part that I struggle with, and this is more on the micro level, is when we're talking about the finances necessary to implement something like this, if we were to go ahead and say this is a good idea, we should do it. I'm willing to bet that the majority party is probably not in favor of the supplemental budget request that came from Minsky, right? So now you're going to ask them to do increasingly more with less money. And that's not a realistic recipe for success in terms of outcomes that we want to accomplish. This is going to be financially very arduous for each school to prepare what you're talking about, both in terms of advisors, reteaching and getting students done, and not only changing curriculum and how we're going to do supplemental education. Do I think that there should be something that helps a student transition who didn't quite get what they need from high school? Absolutely. And should it be done in the high schools? Yes, hopefully it is. But the diversity of two-year schools doesn't allow for that possibility, because we may not get the student until they're 30. Right, and then they're not ready for college programming. So do we need to create something that meets them locally and has that kind of nimbleness to match the population that's going there? We do, and this bill wouldn't allow that either. So I think it's well-intended, and I get what you're trying to accomplish, and I don't think I even disagree with your outcomes. But you're starting from a flawed perspective in terms of where our responsibility lies, in my opinion, and I say that respectfully. I just don't think we agree on that. And the second thing is you're creating a bigger problem financially for us down the road, and how Minsky is going to manage this when we're already asking them to cut their budgets. which I don't think is realistic then to say we're now going to give you another responsibility you've got to go manage that isn't a small task, right? So I struggle to understand how we're going to manage those two things in going forward and making sure MinSKU does this stuff. I guess that's my question is, I mean, what would your response be to I'd be happy to hear, maybe I'm misunderstanding something, and I'd like to know where there might be middle ground that could be reached, I guess. So that's what I have. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Isaacson, I think we will agree more than we disagree. Just because I have this bill in front of us doesn't indicate that I am implying that MinSKU was responsible or it's their fault. So that's first and foremost. I believe that I guess if you wanted to place your blame, it's a combination of it's a trifecta: the student, the school, and the parents. It's a large systemic problem. Certainly, just because the bill is in front of you and it requires MinSKU to flip the bill, if you will, doesn't necessarily mean that I say that they are at fault and they're responsible. However, it really benefits MinSKU and our colleges to work with high schools, and allows that in the bill, in the amendment, to work with high schools even at an earlier age, while in the 11th and 12th grade, to make sure that that student is prepared before they enter college, so they don't have to go through medical courses. You know, a large percentage of folks that have to go, that take remedial courses, end up dropping out of school. So that doesn't benefit them, doesn't benefit their families, doesn't benefit the society, and it doesn't benefit MinSKU or our college campuses. Let that student prepare and go through that 2 years to 3 or 4 years, and guess who eventually will reap the rewards financially? The school. More importantly, the student. So I'm not blaming anyone. As far as the adult basic education, my bill limits it to 5 years prior after school, or prior is before school. I didn't state that right. My bill ends from grade 12 through 5 years. Anything up and above that, it's the impetus is on that student.
Representative Isaacson.
I appreciate that clarification. However, I will tell you that your testifier certainly did imply that it was MinSKU's responsibility and they're dropping the ball. And I don't think that's correct. And that's part of where my reaction to that came. You do have the 5 years in there, and that does give me some comfort, because I think you are kind of acknowledging at that point that what we're saying is the people we've dropped the ball on immediately. But long term, that's kind of up to the adult to make sure that that works, and the school's got to meet them where they are. I think that what I partially struggle with is having, and I'm just going to own it, I'm a bit of a homer for higher education, as you may know, because it's what I do. So I'm not going to pretend like I'm not a little biased, right? But I will tell you that I'm in the faculty meetings and I'm talking to the teachers, and this concept of meeting students where they're at is essentially important. And when we become too prescriptive, it limits our teachers' abilities, our instructors' abilities to be able to meet them where they're at based on what's going on. And that's part of what my concern is as well. And I do believe that, you know, your statement about this being the kind of trifecta is absolutely correct. It's the schools, it's the student, and it's the parent, right, in the beginning. But, I mean, if we're going to really tackle this, and we should be tackling this in K-12 to get our schools ready, we're seeing MinSKU as a resource to help us cross the finish line down there, and if MinSKU is wanting to participate in that, more power to them to create that relationship, because that's important. But ultimately, this solution lies in K-12. And I don't mean like I'm blaming like our K-12 committee somehow did this. I'm not saying that, but that's where the solution lies. And so we keep barking up this tree with concurrent enrollment and all these things, and we want the higher education to fall in line and get this stuff done, and we're asking to solve a problem that isn't theirs to solve necessarily, at least as completely as it seems we're trying to ask them to do that. And so I'm really concerned, and I caution on that level, I guess. So.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. I see someone come up to the testifier stand. Did you need to hear more testimony, or was Representative McDonald's answer sufficient for you?
I think I'm good. I mean, I don't want to stifle anybody. Sorry. I don't want to stop anybody from having the chance to testify. It's up to you. I'm comfortable so far in the discussion where we are, and I imagine there'll be more as we move forward. So.
Okay, Representative McDonald, he's comfortable with the answer. We are getting short on time, so I'm going to move to more members' questions. Okay, and then if we have time at the end, we can circle back. Representative Norton, to your question.
Taking a little different tact here. I don't often talk about my own students, but I'm going to in this instance. I was looking at the information that's passed out, and, you know, my daughter fit in the white 23% here of high school students who needed to take remedial math. And I will tell you that our school does offer remediation for kids who don't do well in math, even in high school. And so she took a summer supplemental course in order to improve her mathematics. And when she went to her post-secondary two-year Rochester Community Technical College, she still was put in remedial math. So I'm not sure, again, we've talked about there being no silver bullet. She was one of those kids who has a lot of stick-to-itiveness and did pay for extra math and did finally graduate and from the University of Minnesota, ultimately. So I guess part of what I, the two points I really want to make here are, last year I passed a bill to have the schools look at co-requisites, as some of you, I think some of you even testified, and it was, you know, using a lot of the information because I'd attended the Complete College Convention, if you will, and I do feel there's a lot of value there in co-requisites, and the report came back, and what I learned in reading that report, it wasn't as comprehensive as I'd liked, and I haven't heard them, Minsky or the U, saying, because of this report, we're going to do X, Y, or Z, and this is kind of doing that for them in a way. But what I read in that report was the need, the use of colleges as microcosms and trying their own solutions that they think will work, and I think they do work. We have in that report several examples of different ideas coming from different colleges and having positive results. My hope had been that they would take those and multiply them out, the things that are working, and this is my push to say, somebody listen and do that. And I am in complete agreement with what you're trying to do here. I'm not sure this is exactly how I would have gone ahead and done it. And frankly, since I did ask for the study and this is my last year, the reason I don't have any language coming forward is because it's not a funding year. So the two issues are we need to fund what we're going to ask these schools to do. And I didn't see anything really in here with the dollar sign. Maybe I missed it or maybe that's coming later. But we really do need to ask for funds in order to move any initiative. And the second note I had along with fiscal and funding is flexibility. And I really think, I know you tried to in the amendment, I'm seeing a little bit of that, but we really, you know, reading that report told me we need to allow our schools the flexibility. That doesn't mean we don't hold them to a result. We do, and we should. But we have to give them the flexibility to do different research-based and proven methods that work and not do a one-size-fits-all. So I think I'm a little in agreement with what I've heard here. I think we're moving in the right direction. I'm not sure this bill is it, frankly, but I think what you want to do is the right thing. It's what I've been wanting to do, and I think a lot of us around this table have been wanting to do, is to make sure our kids aren't wasting time, wasting money, and that get to school and are able to take co-requisites or some other fashion to move them along so they can be successful in the workplace. So I guess it's not really a question. It's, again, more of, you know, a statement here. But just to say, let's make sure we fund what we're asking our schools to do here because they can't do it in a vacuum, and they're already struggling. So I guess that's it.
Representative Norton, and fiscal note, it's been requested, and it's not done yet. So there is a fiscal implication. Representative McDonald, do you want to respond, or do you want me to go on to the next question?
Madam Chair, I would suggest we're going to our patient testifier.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Brandy.
Gandy. Madam Chair and committee members, I just wanted to come back and say, as a position for ESFR, we are by no means saying this problem is Minsky's fault. By no means. When I walked into Minsky at Inverhills, they had never met me. So how can they say, how can I blame them for me needing remediation? But at the same time, Minsky is they give a product. They have consumers. That's what I am as a student, a consumer. And if I come to your door and I'm saying I want to use your services, I want to pay you tuition, then you have a job to meet me where I'm at and provide me with programming and initiative that gets me there. And we're saying Minsky is doing fabulous things. Winona State University, doing amazing programming on their math remediation. And all we're asking is for them to duplicate this across their system. We're not actually trying to prescribe how to do it, and we've been writing with the revisor to try to figure out how do we give them enough autonomy and flexibility to do these programs. But the problem is you cannot offer this in pockets when you have a product and you have more consumers that are in need of this product. So how do we work with Minsky to make sure that these programs are not happening in little pockets, but every school develops its own way of addressing this issue? And that's what we're trying to aim. And as far as the K-12 piece, K-12 does need to get their act together. And we're hoping that by expanding concurrent enrollment, they will be able to do that at the same time while they have the student. And that doesn't cost anything. That's all I have. Thank you.
Representative Joachim, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to apologize, since I'm new to this committee, I'm still trying to figure out how the pieces fit between K through 12 and higher ed, and learning along the way. So looking at Section 1 under Subdivision 10 of the bill before, I think that's still included after the amendment, yeah. It looks like it's talking about being able to have concurrent teaching while the kids are still in secondary, in high school. So I'm wondering how that would fit with the AccuPlacer they currently have to take. I know there's cut scores. If they're under a certain cut score in math or reading with ACT, they're going to have to take an AccuPlacer to see where they fit. Would they be taking the AccuPlacer, let's say, as a junior, then figuring out what remediation that they would need to do, what concurrent remediation they could do before they go to MinSCU, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to my testifier, Mr. Squires.
Yes, thank you. In general, when states do this type of plan, when they move the remediation to the high schools, it really amounts to not wasting the senior year. So typically, they take an assessment at the end of their junior year. That might be ACT in some states, SAT in other states, or AccuPlacer, or whatever the means is. The point is, at that point, why not have the high schools do something with that student to get them ready while they're still in high school? And why not have higher education come in and work with K through 12 on that issue? Kentucky passed Senate Bill 1 in 2009, calling for this very thing. And by the way, I respectfully disagree about the not the nimbleness between the community colleges and the high schools. Kentucky Senate Bill 1 simply called for a partnership between all community colleges and all high schools. So in 6 years, they've seen the remediation go from 67% to 33%. They've literally cut it in half just simply by having colleges work with high schools. The point is that you don't waste the senior year and that you reduce the number who are actually not ready. And, you know, to go from 29% to 27%, that's great, but why not 29% to 10%?
Representative Yoder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that note, I understand with college in the schools and concurrent classes in the high school, that comes with a fiscal note too, and it would here. So I'm wondering if this bill would also have to go through K through 12 finance. Is there a fiscal note that'll impact K through 12?
Well, let me just respond to that real quickly as far as what's happened in other states. The cost of doing this is minimal compared to the cost of not doing it. You're currently having students and parents spend $18 million a year in developmental classes. The point is, you can get a better return on your investment if you spend that money while it's still in high school. A $1.1 million subsidy from Governor Haslam in Tennessee in 1 year saved $6.4 million in tuition and books. $2.5 million the next year saved over $12 million in tuition and books for students.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a second.
Oh, sure.
Because that
sorry about
actually
that.
Needs to go to our nonpartisan
I'm sorry.
Staff. So I'm going to have our nonpartisan staff ask about where the path would be if it moved from here.
Madam Chair and committee members, I would say that when the fiscal note comes back on the introduced version, we would see any cost implications for K-12 schools. And if there were cost implications for K-12 schools, it would, in my opinion, most likely have to go to a K-12 finance committee if there were indeed costs. I can work with MinSCU after following the meeting to see where the fiscal note is at on the introduced version, but I would imagine if the amendment were to become part of the bill, which I assume it is, it will have to go back and do a new version of the fiscal note with the added language from Representative McDonald. The amended language, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Representative Joachim, do you have a follow-up?
Just one quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe that kind of gets to the point with what Representative Norton and Representative Isaacson were saying. While I agree something needs to be done, this is a really good idea. It does cost money. And trust me, hey, I started out as an early childhood advocate. I'm all for getting to kids while they're young and how it costs a lot less to do it then. But it still costs money. So I'm anxious to see this bill go through the process and see what we can do. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yes, in the bill is permissive language for the schools. It's not a mandate.
Thank you.
for
McDonald. Okay, any other member questions? Seeing none, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the audience that would like to speak in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative McDonald, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I would like to remove my motion to, for House File 3083 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus education bill. Correct.
Representative McDonald renews his motion that House File 3083 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Okay.
Thank you, members.
Representative McDonald, are you going to keep that yellow sheet?
I'll be back.
Okay.
Yeah, I just got to see a student that need review.
Just making sure that yellow sheet wasn't coming.
We're a little pinched for time, so we're going to have to move right along here as much as we can without being hurried too much. Our next bill is House File 3090, and Representative O'Neill, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 3090. We recommended to be re-referred to the General Register.
All right, go ahead and begin.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is something that I had brought last session, and we're working on counseling for college students. And we did a pilot program, and I'm going to have my testifier testify to say what had happened and why we want a very small change to try to really get to the population that we were trying to target. And in so doing, with this language change, we should be able to get to the population that we had intended to get to.
Okay. Identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kate Rissavy. I'm the Senior Director of Financial Services for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. For 150 years, LSS is providing service to people with disabilities, older adults, children, youth, and families in all 87 counties statewide in Minnesota. Since 1987, LSS Financial Counseling has been providing financial counseling, financial education, and is now the largest provider of financial counseling, financial education in the state of Minnesota. Since the Minnesota legislature passed the bill to provide funding for a student loan repayment counseling pilot, LSS was selected through a competitive RFP and finalized the contract with the Office of Higher Ed on October 15th, 2015. So since 10-15-15 and March 25th of this year, we've served 302 borrowers for a total of 363 appointments. Some had second appointments, follow-up, but 80% of those are outside the criteria. One of the criteria in the original bill was that they needed to be 30 to 60 days delinquent on their loans in order to be served under this pilot program. So 80% are outside of that window. Many are struggling with their student loan payments but haven't yet missed a payment but are still seeking counseling to understand all of their options. And then some are well beyond that or in default and looking to get back on track with their loans and avoid the devastating financial consequences of this delinquency and default. I can take questions if there are any from the committee at this time.
Members, have any questions? Anyone in the audience? Probably. We're ready to proceed. Representative O'Neill, any final comment?
Well, I appreciate your support in this moving forward to the General Register. This would really get to, the small change would make a big difference in really getting to the population that we'd intended, and that's helping them not to go into default and helping the students restructure their lives and their finances a bit so that they can, they're able to pay their mortgage, their the loans back. So I just ask for your support.
Want to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion that House File 3090 be re-referred to the General Register.
House File 3090 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Done. Next bill, unless we'll proceed to House File 2798.
Okay.
Representative O'Neill, would you like to move your motion for your bill, please?
I would like to move House File 2798 be referred to the General Register. Members and Mr. Chair, this is the pipeline bill, the dual training bill, come back. And I'm going to have my testifiers come up. I've got a couple people here that would like to just speak very quickly to this changes that we wanted to make to the bill. And as we're coming up, I'll just tell you very quickly, as the bill rolled out and it's in its infancy, really, as we're moving forward with the dual training, we found that there were some hang-ups along the way, and this bill really gets to making it easier for those that are applying to for the employers that are applying for the grant. It also gets to the real need, which is new hires as opposed to incumbent workers. So the changes that we made are primarily in those two major areas of focusing on new hires, and especially those with high school education, and then making it easier for employers to apply, and a slight change in how they can pay for it so that it gets to both of their needs. And with that, I'm going to turn it over first to Ohi, who's here to testify. Since we're in the Higher Ed Committee, this is our third stop, so we've talked about this quite a bit. But I'll just turn it over to my testifier to go into some of the details of the bill changes.
All right. Welcome, and identify yourself for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nicole Sorensen. I'm a research analyst with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education and working to administer the Pipeline Project dual training grants. So we became a part of the Pipeline Project last year after the grant program was created, and so we've been partnering with DLI. They've been the lead on the Pipeline Project, so it's been a really fruitful partnership. Our first round of grants were awarded in December. The grantees were selected in December, and then those awards have been going out this winter. We're excited that we had 15 employers apply in the first round, and then they were selected for receiving the grants. That included 125 student employees, and we awarded $490,500-ish in the first round of grants. So given that was a very quick turnaround for applicants, we were excited that they were able to jump in and apply in the first round and be a part of this pilot program with us. So as Representative O'Neill stated, that there were some technical changes that will make this easier for employers and their employees and students to be a part of, and so we're very supportive of the changes that have been made here, and I'd just be happy to take any questions as needed.
Okay. Maybe we can hold questions until we have all the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Lumen, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and we don't get to hang out in your committee very often, so it's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you very much. We have been really excited to be a part of this project, and the reason that the Pipeline Project is at the Department of Labor and Industry is because it's really based on the registered apprenticeship model that has been very successful in the United States and around the world for hundreds of years. And what's a little bit different about the Pipeline Project is that this is employment-based training. So everyone who's participating in the Pipeline Project is the employee of a participating employer in an occupation where the industry has all agreed what the competencies are for that occupation. And so we have more than 40 employers who are participating in the Pipeline Project right now. 15 of those have recently been awarded grants in order to help fund the related instruction component of the Pipeline Project. So it's a really great program. We're happy to be partnering with Office of Higher Education. Really appreciate the support of champions like Representative O'Neill and Representative Norton. And happy to take any questions about the project itself.
Okay, thank you. And one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Larson. I'm an instructor in the Automation and Robotics program at Hennepin Tech College. We are one of the programs that has had a fair number of students come through. Right now we have between 10 and 12 students who are taking our courses through the pipeline grant, and they are coming from 3 to 5 different companies in a field of mechatronics where the Department of Labor estimates that there's about 2,900 job openings per year. Minsky is graduating somewhere around 300 to 350 students in this field, so the demand for these students is very high at very high wages. So through this grant, employers are able to hire young people, pay for their education, and then have a commitment of those students to stay with that company for a number of years to improve that company's workforce. Right now, like I said, we have 10 to 12 students through the first round of funding with this. Based on the time frame, it was a condensed time frame. As we move forward, I believe many more students will be able to take advantage of this, and many more companies. One company, Design Ready Controls, started out with approximately 5 students in the program. Going for fall semester, they're looking to expand to 10 to 15 students in this program. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Neal, is there any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair, those are all the testifiers, and if there's any questions, I can go through some of the more specific changes in the bill, but I can just open up for questions.
Okay, we'll open up for members. Seeing none? Just kidding. Thank you. Representative Isaacson. Aye.
Thanks.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I wish you would.
Okay.
Most people do.
Okay.
So that works out well. I am wondering, and I don't know if you have someone to answer the question, but I would like to ask a question about curriculum development as it relates to this. One of the bill, correct me if I'm wrong, part of the bill talks about doing an assessment of all the programs that are currently out there so we can kind of fill in where the gaps are between what the employers need and what the programs are. Is that correct?
So I do have a couple.
Representative
O'Neill? Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Isaacson, I do have a couple people that can speak to that. And I think what you're referring to is it's a work together with OHI and DALI, and that they're going to be doing an inventory. Mm-hmm. And on that inventory, you can kind of see like which school is offering which training program that goes along with the competencies. And let's see if I could have Mike, if you want to come up. Do you want to speak to that? Okay. So I have one more test fire to answer that question.
Okay, welcome. Again, state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Mike McGee. I'm System Director for Industry Education Partnerships at the Minsky System Office.
Do you need to have the question
I can,
stated?
Yeah, let me be.
Isaacson?
Well, Mike and I just talked about an hour ago, so part of it has been answered, but I think it's important for us to think about this as a committee. As someone who teaches inside the Minsky system, there's certain components of this bill that it implies that kind of set it up for a failure, in my opinion, down the road. And I'm not sure that it's specifically just this part, but overall the way we approach it, and you and I have talked about this as well. And so maybe similar to the question when we spoke earlier was, my concern is that curriculum development is not a nimble process in Minsky. It's an arduous one. It can take several months, maybe over a year to do. Part of what this bill is trying to do is create a way in which we can have Minsky respond to industry quickly to meet the needs of for employers' needs for jobs, right? And so those two together in this bill in a way that's effective, because my concern is having watched curriculum drag on for a while, I mean, really the nuts and bolts of it will get done, we'll get the competencies done, some suggestions will be made to the college of choice, what we need to accomplish, and then it's going to go before a faculty curriculum committee, and that's where you're going to lose a lot of the efficiency in that respect. And I think not necessarily in a bad way, but just that's just the nature of the way that works. How is Minsky going to manage that need while giving a degree that's portable to the skills we're saying you have so you can move on in your job career?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Isaacson and I did talk about an hour ago, and I anticipated the question, and so really what has happened is we heard loud and clear from industry members that they were concerned, too, from industry meetings about how they would be nimble themselves about connecting with campuses and understanding the curriculum that they needed to fulfill the outcomes that were desirable for their sector. And so we started working way back in January with the campuses using our Centers of Excellence to inquire about the programming, which programming was going to be relevant to which industry sectors. So we've already begun some of the inventory work. Additionally, we're engaging faculty to crosswalk, if you will, the individual coursework to the industry outcomes that were identified by industry members in the industry council meetings over the last year and a half. And it's recognized that there'll be some gaps between what is credit-based curriculum, in other words, inventory off-the-shelf curriculum offered currently by the campuses, and what industry partners will deliver in the workplace. That's the dual training nature of the pipeline program. And we believe that we can fill that gap either through non-credit customized courses that are generally quickly put together, or even custom credit courses, which also are or can be quickly put together, using the same faculty who deliver the credit-based curriculum to deliver those customized courses to fill those gaps. And we've made good progress there.
Representative Isaac.
Thank you. So when you talk about non-credit customized courses, who's paying for that? The student, the business, or the state through the pipeline bill?
Well, I guess it would depend. If it was a large enough cohort of business businesses together with the students, say a dozen or so, the businesses would pay for it.
Okay.
Right.
Just if I can interrupt for just a second. I'd like the next bill to have about a 15-minute time period. We can be as succinct in our questions as possible on this bill. So if we're fair to Mr. Representative Baker. So.
You bet.
Representative Isaacson.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I think that what I'm trying to get at, and I love the way that it works. I think that's an important model, and I think getting MinSKU there is difficult long-term to create that kind of credit curriculum that's going to allow for the bill to be. So part of the point of this bill is to make it so you get a degree while you're working that's then portable, right? Because the whole focus is that we're paying for the degree, not the training.
Right.
That's kind of the rub there, right? And if we're getting too far into the other side, we're paying for training. And I'm not comfortable with that. And the other side of it is that if the bill doesn't match credit-wise, you can't say your degree does what you say it did, then it's not portable in a way that's useful. So that's the two things don't seem to match together for me when I hear how we're creating this. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable with how MinSKU is being put into that situation. I'm not sure that MinSKU was given the tools to solve that problem the way we're talking about what we want the outcome to be of the pipeline bill. And so I guess that's my concern. And we've kind of went around and around on that. But I think that's important for us to hear that. Because that's when down the road, if we have a problem, more than likely that's going to be part of where the problem lies in how the outcomes work on this bill, because we're not going to be able to reach that the way we need to, unless you do, as we talked about, economies of scale, which service just our largest manufacturers, who have enough people put into it that they can actually create curriculum around that. But it leaves, you know, 80% of the manufacturers out the door unable to sustain that size, in my opinion. But that's just me. Thanks.
And thank you for your thoughts, because you have probably more experience in this whole arena than I know I do. So it's good to hear that. Any other final testimony, Representative O'Neill?
We were just debating who wanted to maybe get to that. I'm just going to do kind of a broad, again, thing about the program is it's $6,000 is the amount of the grant per year over the course of 4 years, you know, if it takes them that long. If the company has a gross revenue of $25 million or more, then they put in 25% towards the education. So, and then the student also applies, or the employee, the student also applies for state grants and Pell grants and things like that too. So, I guess I'm not a little confused as to why the question of who's paying for what, because I thought it was pretty well spelled out that, you know, and we also defined in this new version basically that the cost of the training is tuition fees and the books and the materials that are required. So if whether it happens on site or in a Minsky institution, I think I'm pretty sure the language is covering all of that, unless I'm missing something, but I believe that's how it's covered.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think based on just the answer we heard, it's clearly not clear. That was a horrible way to say that. It is not clear to me, because we are saying we're filling in gaps with the customized training from the professor in either credit or non-credit work, right? And that means that we're specifically training to the needs of the actual business rather than training to the needs of what the degree is. And if we're training to the needs of the business and the state's paying for it, I think that violates some sense of that in terms of how we've approached state training for private businesses in the past. So, and I'm not clear, and I've not heard an answer that maybe nuances that correctly. But I'd be interested in hearing more, but I don't want to take I mean, we can have this debate for a while longer. So,
Mr. Chair, we just have a very quick answer from the
Mr. Chairman and Representative Isaacson, I think one of the things that's important to just think about when we're contemplating this program is that one of the things that we've been very careful about is not talking about the pipeline project and equating that with curriculum. Our higher education institutions, our other training programs, they are responsible for developing curriculum that meets degree and certification requirements. What the pipeline project does, and I think this is where there's a little bit of disconnect, what the pipeline project does is it establishes industry-wide, industry-recognized competencies. So it has categories of things like, and I can give you an example, but like, you know, CNC would be an occupation that it would do, and inside that would be machine awareness. It would be machine safety. It would be different competencies and just big categories that the industries all agree. If you're going to be a CNC operator in Minnesota, this is what you need to know. Then what we have done is we've worked with our partners at MinSU, we've worked with other training partners, we've worked with our partners at OHE, and the related instruction providers are the people who develop the curriculum that helps meet the competencies that have been identified by the industry. And I do want to just share that we are working in four different industries right now, and we're doing lots of different work, and all the industries are very different in terms of their readiness state, in terms of their occupational needs. So we're working in agriculture, advanced manufacturing, IT, and healthcare. And each of those industries is doing their own work in competency, and each of those industries is then working in concert with the offices of higher education and the MinSU system.
So I think you've perfectly illustrated to me why this bill is in the wrong committee, first of all, and has no business in higher education. It should be in the jobs, because you just said that we're not worried about curriculum and how we're creating for these programs. It's all about the competencies. Absolutely. And the second thing is, I think it would be short-sighted to believe that those competencies weren't leading to a marriage curriculum. I mean, why else would we create the competencies if it wasn't leading to a marriage curriculum with the schools? And so, I mean, fundamentally, the problem I had, as I had last year when we passed the bill, was that it was coming out of higher ed and should have been coming out of jobs, because that's where the domain is. And we all know only because jobs wouldn't pass it in the Senate, so higher ed had to. And that's an initial problem I have, but even larger is the way we're paying for this I'm not so comfortable with. But I
thank you. Representative O'Neill. We're getting ready to renew your motion.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 2798 be referred to the General Register.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? That's fair. All right. Thank you very much. Representative Baker. Been a busy day.
Yes, it has, Mr.
Running
Chair.
Around. Glad you're here to testify. I move that House File 2660 be laid over. That's our intent. Representative Baker, if you want to begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Appreciate your time and squeezing me in at the very end here. Members, 2660 is an important bill that appropriates $280,000 to cover the costs of four medical students, residents actually, specializing in something that's very important to me, and that's addiction medicine. The Board of Medical Specialties just this month officially recognized the addiction medicine as a subspecialty within medicine, which is the first hurdle in receiving graduate and medical education, funding hopefully at the end of 2017 when the program is fully accredited. Fellows are uniquely trained at Hennepin County Medical Center and the University of Minnesota Fairview. The need for physicians trained in addiction medicine is more important today than ever before. In the last 10 years, deaths from opioids has tripled in the state of Minnesota. Drug overdose is a leading cause of injury death in Minnesota as well as the nation. Addiction is a disease that can affect anyone from any part of our state and walk of life. The Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program trains doctors in a variety of interventions from people suffering from addictions, which may include detoxification, rehabilitation, harm reduction, and others. With me today, I have David Godfrey, and I'll let him introduce himself, Mr. Chair, and go through with my expert stuff, and we'll wrap it up fairly quickly, I think. Thank you.
All right. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is David Godfrey, and I'm the Director of Public Policy at Hennepin County Medical Center. Also joining me up here today is Dr. Michael Belzer, the former Chief Medical Officer at HCMC, who is now assisting us with public policy and advocacy work. Dr. Belzer is here to answer questions that might relate to clinical issues that might arise or specifics about graduate medical education. HCMC has the only addiction medicine clinic that uses an integrated approach to treating the whole person. We provide a number of services to address not only the disease of addiction, but also the co-occurring mental and physical health conditions that these patients experience. Our clinic has been in existence since 1994, and last year alone, we provided over 86,000 clinic visits to patients in need. HCMC is proud to be one of only 26 sites throughout the country to host an addiction medicine fellowship program. Through this program, we educate physicians who have completed their residency training and who want to specialize in treating substance abuse disorders. Currently, the program in Minnesota and other programs nationwide lack federal funding to fully train the number of fellows needed to meet the growing addiction crisis we are facing. For instance, HCMC's program has the capacity to train 4 fellows, 2 first-year and 2 second-year students. But because of the limited funds, we are only able to train 1 fellow at this time. And that's because HCMC must fund this training out of its own budget. Given our razor-thin margins as a safety net hospital, this continued subsidy is not sustainable for our budget. 65% of physicians trained at HCMC go on to practice in other settings across the state. So we view their education as something that benefits all of Minnesota, not just HCMC patients. The reason this current funding gap exists is because federal graduate medical education dollars do not currently support addiction medicine as a qualified subspecialty for training. This is because addiction medicine as a field of study has not been accredited by the American College of Graduate Medical Education, or ACGME. This is typical for new subspecialties, and it often takes many years for these new areas of medicine to become accredited. For example, the training in the subspecialty of emergency medicine took 20 years from the time its first residency program began in 1961 until it was approved by the ACGME. HCMC and the American Board of Addiction Medicine have been actively pursuing accreditation for the last 10 years. We're happy to report, as Representative Baker mentioned, that the ACGME will begin to accredit the programs in 2017, which means we'll be able to access federal funds in 2018 or 2019. In the meantime, this bill can help fill a funding gap and is an excellent opportunity to address the growing crisis of addiction in our state by training skilled health care specialists who can provide expert care above and beyond that of a general practitioner. Medical students, on average, receive only 6 to 8 hours on addiction in their medical training. This is half the amount of the time they spend training on bioterrorism. The lack of attention addiction receives in training programs points to a disconnect between the immediate needs of our citizens and the medical training being provided in our institutions. Thank you for taking the time to hear this important legislation. I believe you have a handout in your packet regarding the Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. You'll see on that document that the bill is supported by HCMC, Hazleton Betty Ford Foundation, NAMI of Minnesota, the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers, and the Coalition for Recovery Investment. And so with that, I'll take any questions you might have.
All right, thank you very much. Very important topic. Members? Dr. Belzer, are you here for a backup, or did you have some testimony you want to share?
Mr. Chair, I'm just here for any questions about the clinical aspects of the training or the funding.
Okay, thanks for being here. Members?
Yeah.
Representative O'Neill.
I just have a really quick comment, and I feel like I've monopolized the time today, but I just want to thank you, Representative Baker, for bringing this forward and being someone that has spent some time in working in chemical dependency. It's when they told me how little time is actually spent on training our physicians and in this area. It was shocking, really. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I look forward to this moving forward and a whole lot more, and hopefully we have even more emphasis in other committees as well in health and healing and change, and especially in dependency, as we literally touches every committee that I'm on. So thank you.
Representative Baker, any final words?
Just finally, Mr. Chair and members, again, this is very special. It is needed. This is a one-time funding request because, as they mentioned, this is a gap that we need to not allow to open up the hole for three more docs that don't get the training that really need it. So I hope it works out. I appreciate your consideration today. And again, this is very, very important to us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. House File 2660, then we'll be laid over. Thank you, Reverend.
Thank you.
Seeing that's the end of our agenda, we are adjourned.